For the record, I am Joe Pickard, P-I-C-K-A-R-D, attorney registration 12476. I represent the appellant, Mrs. Susan Berry. To begin with, I'd like to address a couple of smaller matters and then get to the meat of the case. The case really has to do with the amount of child support and maintenance under all the facts and circumstances considered or not considered by the magistrate and approved by the district court. The first couple of matters I'd like to address, though, are significant, but in the context of the argument, not as significant, so I'll end with the more important issues. But I want to say first, with respect to, there's an issue of the effectivity date of the modification of child support. Our argument has been that there was a voluntary change of custody of the triplet children, who are now just 14 years old as of last month, from the father. All three of them lived with him, and then they moved to live with the appellant. Our argument was under 1410.122, subparagraph 5, that any change in child support should revert to that date. Counsel on the other side has submitted in the briefs the case of Inter Marriage White and Martin. I've read that case and thought about it carefully, and I think that case stands for the proposition that only the obligor, that's the person that owed the obligation prior to the voluntary change, is entitled to that backdating. That's different than the position I took in the briefs, and so I wanted to point that out to the court. Having looked at that, though, more carefully and reading that case, what it says in In Re Marriage White and Martin is that the change should be effective as of the time of the filing of the motion under 122 subparagraph 1, unless the court finds undue hardship or substantial injustice.
Because, I'm sorry to interrupt, but did the magistrate consider the fact that the husband was paying $40,000 a month and there was not a need for child support under those circumstances, and the parties agreed to that?
He did, Your Honor. And he said that he did anyway. The issue that I have with that is that in including the $40,000, the reason she got $40,000 and not more is because there wasn't an obligation for her to pay him child support. And since I had thought of it that way, that's why I always thought of her as the obligor. But he said that. But what he didn't do was say, under the facts and circumstances of this case, that that constituted substantial injustice. And I don't think he really could, under the facts and circumstances of this case, because even the month before the hearing in March of 2010, his expenses for 1 month were $60,000 a month, more than usual. $60,000 or even $40,000 or even especially some part of $40,000 was not substantial injustice in this case. And that will lead into some other arguments I'll make in just a few minutes about the overall numbers in this case, which are enormous.
Mr. Pickard, can I ask you just, and I know you want to get to the meat, so yes. I'll be brief. On the statute, 1410.122.1d, does the court have discretion? As you just said yourself, it does say should. It doesn't say shall make it retroactive. So I'm just curious, in your view, what it should mean here.
I'm just relying on my own memory of the case, and I don't know, Judge, whether it said should or...
Well, if the statute says should.
It says should, okay.
Yeah.
Then I would just argue that the court needs to make that finding before it says I'm not going to make it retroactive. And especially the court should make that finding if it's going to find a different date for the modification and maintenance, as happened in this case. For some reason, the court made the effective date of the maintenance modification the beginning of the month, of March 2010. March 16th was the hearing, and child support didn't start until April 1st. And that was one of the issues, and I'll get into the next smaller issue, about the submittal of the forms of order. And that's a real problem. And I thought carefully about the cases counsel cited on that also. The two cases cited by counsel were Poudre Valley and Union Insurance. And both of those are district court opinions. And in both cases, the court did something for it was supposed to under 121. In the Poudre Valley case, there was the court asked for written summations, never got one from the second side, entered an order before the summation was submitted. In the other case, Union Insurance, there was a response to a motion either for summary judgment or to dismiss, and the court ruled before receiving all the motions and briefs. In both of those cases, however, and counsel's argued under CRCP Rule 61, it's harmless error. In both of those cases, the reviewing court, before it went up on appeal, had a chance to see what the arguments were. In the circumstances here, I was in the position of appealing a magistrate's order, which, as this court knows, under the Colorado Rules for Magistrates, Rule 7, A5, I think, there's only one motion I can file, and that's a motion to review. I can't supplement the record before the magistrate and ask him to reconsider, because all I can do is ask for a review by the district court. And when the district court gets it, it's a review on the record. I can't say, here's some more stuff I think you should consider about the order.
Well, if I can ask you, Mr. Pickard, on this one, and I'll just be candid with you, my concern with your argument, I think everyone admits it was an error for the court to sign the order without giving your client a shot to answer. But maybe you're saying that it's prejudicial per se. Yeah, I mean, if that's your position, I'd be interested in case law.
No.
But it strikes me as, I guess I'll just ask, why is it not harmless? You haven't identified anything in the written order that was inconsistent with the oral findings that I've seen, number one, nor, and I guess these emails were attached when the order was proposed. You've never indicated that there was something other than what was in the emails, at least in the briefs I've read. So I guess I'm not hearing what the problem is, unless your position it was a per se reversible error.
I think it is under circumstances when you're reviewing a magistrate's order, because you don't have a chance to respond. Even on appeal, I could submit an affidavit. I'd give you testimony now about other things that I wanted to say, but I couldn't add it to the record before the magistrate after he ruled, the day he got the proposal from the other side. I couldn't do it before the district court, and I can't do it here. So in a review of a magistrate's order that comes up on appeal, I think it is per se, because the court below never has a chance to see my position. And if doing this for a while makes any difference, this is happening all the time, where people just take emails where you're going back and forth about what the form of order should be and why, and attaching it to stuff and sending it to the court. And then the court has to decide in this case based upon opposing counsel's characterization of what my argument is. If he understood my argument, we wouldn't be arguing about it. Just like I didn't understand his a little bit until I read his brief and read the cases and got prepared for today. But that's not how it goes on a day-to-day basis. And this is happening all the time. I just don't think that's the way to do it, is to submit what you think the other person's argument is by using their email, which were really negotiation discussions about what should be in the order. And in this case, one of the things I said, and I would, if the court, if Your Honor is saying that the oral record of the court's ruling was clear about when the child support and when the maintenance should start, I would disagree. He started to say, I'm going to say this stuff is now. And it's in the transcript at around page 275.
And just so I'm clear, I was just asking you if there's something in the oral findings that you think didn't make it in the written findings or vice versa.
I think the oral findings were ambiguous. And if you read through those, you see that it's not real clear that he wants one to start on one date and one to start on the other.
So the written order
came out in written order.
So the written order, you think, was inconsistent with the oral findings in that regard?
Yes.
Have you said that in your brief to us?
Perhaps not well enough, Your Honor.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Okay, now, with respect to the issue of amount of child support, there's two issues here. One is support, one's maintenance. With respect to maintenance, the findings are better, and I'm not going to defend that as strongly. I still think, under all the circumstances, this is an abuse of discretion on both counts. But with respect to maintenance, the court order specifically says in paragraph 3 that it's considering the factors set forth in 1410.114 and 122. It doesn't make any mention of 115. The child support statute is not mentioned. And specific factors under 115 are not only not described in either the oral order or the written order of the magistrate, but in fact he makes one determination in paragraph 11 that's contrary to law. So it's not only an abuse of discretion, but on that one, I think, a legal error.
And the child support, you agree, though, that their income was outside the statutory?
Absolutely was. And whenever there's going to be a deviation, not just beyond that, I think that's, I don't know if that's a deviation because you're above the top. But when you're going to, one of the things it says in 1410.115, subparagraph 8, is that if you're going to have a deviation, you may consider non-income producing assets. And that's the thing that I need to say to you today. He has a $30 million house that doesn't show up on the financial affidavit anywhere, that is not considered by the court. And in fact, in paragraph 11 of the magistrate's order, he says specifically he's not going to consider it. When it's a statutory factor, it's a discretionary statutory factor. I'm not saying because it exists, he must do something else. But what he mustn't do is say that it is not a factor for his consideration. And orally, what he said was, he started to say it's irrelevant. And he corrected himself and said, well, it's just not important. And then in the order said, more specifically, I'm not going to consider it. That's just error. What he really didn't consider, and this is the general abuse of discretion, is the lifestyle of the children. There's discussion in the case about, he calls it the lifestyles of the rich and famous, because he talks about the fact that this guy is spending $233,000 a month, which is exactly what he was spending 5 years previous at the time of the divorce. But he only has approximately $105,000 income, except the income is never determined because the affidavit that's supplied to the court was disputed by Mr. Berry at the hearing in his testimony. And then he deferred to his expert, Mr. Vincent, and Mr. Vincent said he didn't have a handle on it either. The record references are for Mr. Vincent at 160, excuse me, I'm going to include that Mr. Vincent doesn't know how much Mr. Berry's expenses are either. He says he doesn't know what his expenses are and he doesn't know what his income is. For the expenses, the record references are at page 169 and 172. On the income, at 177, Mr. Vincent says there's $100,000 of miscellaneous deposits that nobody can account for. $100,000 of deposits and nobody knows where they're coming from. That Mr. Berry says he doesn't know what his income is at the very end of his cross-examination at page 257. Mr. Berry admits that he's going to make, he argues in cross and direct, of $60,000 to $180,000 on the sale of one house, and he has $1 million in Berry Bryant Enterprises, which apparently was not supplied to his accountant. And Mr. Vincent doesn't have any idea what that is, and refers to it as a mishmash of materials. That's his expert at page 174 of the transcript. Income was not established. Expenses were not established. The lifestyle of children is not mentioned in the order. That's a statutory factor. And since the court didn't say, as it did in a global wholesale fashion, I'm considering everything I need to under 114 and 122, then I don't think this court should make any assumptions about what the basis for that is. The lifestyle of children is not discussed. There's no finding about that. There was plenty of testimony about it. Mrs. Berry talked about how they used to have, they chartered their jets, they had five-star hotels, and there's just no question that spending money was not an issue for this family. And nothing changed in the spending of Mr. Berry, as I've cited the court in the Gray case, where a man got severance pay, didn't change his standard of living, didn't change his lifestyle one bit. And so when he appealed what was a slight modification of maintenance in the Gray case at 813 P. 2nd 819, and cited in both briefs, really, for different reasons, it was determined that his own expectation was that he would continue to live that kind of lifestyle. Just got about a minute left. I would just stop at this point and say this. This case is about whether or not children ought to be allocated some aspect of the lifestyles of their parents. It's a statutory factor. The court made no findings about it. It's clear that the lifestyle of Mr. Berry never changed. And the fact that he's spending money or losing money in gross amounts, and I'll mention some of those in my final few seconds, is not a reason for his children to get less.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Mike Zweibel. I represent the appellee in this matter, Richard Berry. And I will address, Mr. Pickard chose three issues from his brief to address today, and I will address those three issues. First of all, with regard to the propriety of the written order, the purpose of reducing the court's oral ruling to writing is to simply accurately reflect the court's ruling. It's not the place to make argument or to ask for modification. And quite obviously, the entity or the person that's in the best position to know when a written order accurately reflects the court's ruling is the court. And that's precisely what happened here. The court got the written ruling. Oh, by the way, the court had also issued a written ruling before it ever got the written ruling that was submitted, the proposed written ruling that was submitted by Mr. Berry. The court issued a signed and dated minute order 2 days after its oral rulings that summarized the oral ruling. And like the oral ruling, it also is accurately reflected in the written order. And I think there's an argument here that the second written order was superfluous because there already was a signed and dated written order, a minute order from the court that the court signed and dated. Be that as it may, I think an argument could be made that a court in that situation doesn't necessarily abuse its discretion because it has determined that this is its ruling. That's the only question. But we don't need to talk about that because it's quite obviously harmless error. Mr. Pickard has never identified, not below, not in the appellate briefs, and not today, a single way in which the written ruling departs from the court's oral ruling. And I attached to my brief the transcript of the oral ruling, a copy of the written ruling, so the court can compare for itself and see that they are exactly the same. And so I really think that takes care of that issue. I can be disposed of, I think, as a matter of harmless error. With regard to modification or establishment of child support, the court correctly noted that the primary factor, the thing it has to consider above all else, is the children's needs. And there is case law on that. I've cited it in the brief. When the court deviates from the guidelines, deviates upward from the guidelines, the primary consideration is the children's needs. And the court found that no extraordinary needs have been demonstrated for these children.
As I understand Mr. Pickard's argument, the extraordinary need is that children in the position of these children are entitled to a pro rata share, for want of a better term, of the lifestyle of their parents.
Well, I don't think that's what the case law says. The case law doesn't. It's not. The case law doesn't say that the children are entitled to a lot of money just because the parents have a lot of money. In fact, both parents have a lot of money here. And I guess we should, I want to mention that because it was factors that were considered by the court as well. But I'll get back to that. But the court, Mr. Pickard, I think, is saying the court didn't consider the lifestyle of the children. But the court, in fact, explicitly did. If you look at the oral ruling and the written ruling, the court said, look, when these folks were married, they appeared to have unlimited mountains of money, and they spent it that way. But now things have changed. And the court specifically considered that the trust, which is the source of all of the wealth for all of these people, wife, children, husband, that's where it all comes from, had been depleted from $30 million to $10 million. $10 million of the depletion came from the stock market, according to Mr. Vincent, and the court accepted that and made it a finding from the stock market declines. And the rest came from the upkeep on the home. Now, the home, which Mr. Pickard talks about, the $30 million home, is not owned by Mr. Berry. That is owned by the trust. Mr. Berry can't turn it into cash. And so the court properly did not consider that as an asset that could produce income for the purpose of child support. Mr. Berry couldn't sell it if he wanted to. He can't take a loan on it. It's not his. What he is required to do, though, to live there, is he's required to keep it up. And it's a big house, as we can tell from the price tag on it. And so it has a lot of upkeep. And Mr. Vincent talked about that and about the amount of upkeep that's required And Mr. Vincent came to the conclusion that if $1.2 million is expended annually for the upkeep of the home, which is pretty much what's necessary, the trust will be completely gone in 2016. And so the court considered that. The court considered, you know, the court doesn't have to ensure that all the money is transferred to the children now. The court has to ensure that the children are cared for. And I think the court looked at the declining resources of the husband, looked at the fact that the wife herself has a $2.5 million house, vehicles worth $700,000, $1 million in the bank, $600,000 in capital gains income every year, plus the maintenance that she's getting. And I think the court properly determined that these children are not going to suffer. The court also considered the fact that the children have $9 million of their own resources, including a $6.4 million trust. And so to argue that somehow these children are bereft, that they are in some way not being cared for, given the resources, I think it defies reason and common sense. The court considered the children's needs. The court considered the resources of the husband and the resources of the wife. And the court specifically made a finding that the lifestyle of the parties has changed and can no longer support the lavish lifestyle that they were used to during marriage. And so the court, I think, hit all the bases and was well within its discretion. I think Mr. Pickard essentially is asking this court to reweigh the evidence. There's a lot of ways any court could go on this evidence. Mr. Berry asked for $10,000 a month in maintenance, and the court rejected that. I think an argument could be made that wife is entitled to no maintenance because she's got so many resources of her own. But there's no arguing with it. The court properly weighed the factors. There is competent evidence in the record to support the court's findings, and I think that really is the end of the matter. With regard to retroactivity of...
Before I go on to that, Mr. Zweibel, if I can ask you, there was some reference to an agreement among the parties to have the, well, maybe you're going to get to this, the child support be retroactive. Was there some, it wasn't very clear to me. Was there an agreement on that?
There's no agreement I know of.
Okay.
That the parties would make child support retroactive.
All right.
The separation agreement, which I quoted in the brief, and of course it's also in the record, says that because the wife is getting $40,000 a month maintenance, they agreed that no child support is necessary for so long as that occurs, and that only when that stops would it be necessary to consider modification. Which I guess brings me to the retroactivity argument, which I've gone at it three ways in the brief, because I think there's three possible ways to analyze this. One is that this order really establishes child support and doesn't modify child support, and so it's actually governed by Section 115 and not Section 122. And in that case, I think there's no question that the court has discretion about making the child support retroactive. And certainly it was within its discretion, the court was within its discretion to decide that it wasn't going to make the support retroactive so long as the wife was still getting $40,000 a month maintenance. The parties thought that was fair, and the court also specifically thought that was fair. To the extent Section 122 applies, there are two possible provisions that apply, 1D or subsection 5. 1D provides that it says two things. It says that the court should make it retroactive to the date of the motion unless it would be substantially unjust, and of course I'm paraphrasing there. But it also says that modification is only warranted upon a show of substantial changed circumstances. And the continuing and substantial changed circumstances that warranted going from zero child support to $5,000 a month child support didn't occur until the $40,000 a month maintenance stopped. And so the argument which we made and which can be made is that the very basis for any modification of child support under 122 didn't exist under 1D until the $40,000 a month maintenance was modified. And so that is the argument under 1D. Under subsection 5, the language of subsection 5 regarding change of custody is there, I'll quote, that the modification that what may be modified, and I'm quoting, is provisions for child support of the obligor under the existing child support order. And although the court in Marriage of White and Martin didn't specifically address the situation, the exact situation we have here, what it did say is that language means what it says. It's plain, it's unambiguous, and it means what it says. And so you have to have an obligor, and you have to have an existing child support order. And we didn't have either of those here. There was no obligor, there was no existing child support order. So I think no matter how you cut it, there was no requirement that the court make the child support retroactive in this case. And if there are no other questions, I just thank the court for its time.
Thank you, Mr. Zweibel. Mr. Pickard.
I'll just end with this. The affidavit of Mr. Berry indicated 60 days before the hearing that he was spending $12,000 a month on miscellaneous expenses, $250,000 a month, and a total of $31,000 a month on legal, $5,000 a month on charity, $8,000 a month on vacations, $30,000 for other household staff, $23,000 for sports tickets, and $6,000 for a nanny that didn't watch the children anymore. It's an abuse of discretion.
Mr. Pickard, I know your time's up, but just a quick question. I thought I read this somewhere that there was some agreement to run child support retroactive. I could be making this up,
Here's the argument to respond to, I think, what you just
said. Because your time's up, but just a factual question. Was there any kind of agreement about that?
No.
Okay. Okay, go ahead.
What there was in the separation agreement was an agreement that if maintenance got modified, that would constitute a basis to modify or establish child support.
Retroactively or no?
It didn't say. It just said okay. That would be a basis.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Pickard. Thank you again, Mr. Zweibel. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written order to issue in due course.